Good morning, everyone. I will call the meeting of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. The first order of business is the approval of the minutes. Representative Hudson, Vice Chair Hudson, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair, and I would move their approval.
The minutes from February 25th have been moved. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted. We're going to mix up the order a little bit from what's on the agenda today. Representative Anderson has another commitment to get to, so we're going to have her go first with House File 1. Welcome to the committee, and please state, well, we know who you are. Go ahead. It looks like I will move House File 25 before, or excuse me, House File 1 before the committee. And I believe there are a few amendments. The motion will be to re-refer the bill to the Committee on Children and Families Finance and Policy. What are the amendments? Okay. Representative Anderson, why don't you tell us a little bit about your bill, and then we'll move in the amendments.
Thank you, and thank you, Chairman Scott. I will be very brief because I know a lot of you have heard this bill already in other committees. This House File 1 is essentially sets up a Office of Inspector General, merges the existing offices that are within some of the agencies, six or seven agencies, depending on whether you count corrections. I think they're going to change their name so that they're not part of it, by the way, because they don't really do those duties. But merges those into an independent Office of Inspector General. A little, just a brief background, you may be aware, this is a bipartisan bill. We've been working with colleagues from all four caucuses, essentially, the House, the Senate, and we've been meeting regularly, and that's part of what one of the amendments we'll talk about. So the goal is to bring the House and the Senate language together. So that we can have a bill that all of us are very proud of and will help prevent some of the fraud that we've been seeing in the state of Minnesota in the future. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. I believe you have an author's amendment first, so we'll take up the A-15. I will move the A-15. Can you explain to us what the A-15 does?
Thank you, Chairman Scott. The A-15 is it's a little bit of a mix of things that came up in other committees, like Subdivision 6. There was a desire to define misuse. We took the words waste and abuse out because we thought they were subjective, a little too subjective, and replaced that with misuse. And so the definition of misuse is in the bill, is in this amendment. And then a lot of the other language, a little bit was classified versus unclassified. We've clarified that, and the rest of it is actually Senate language. So if from our meeting on Tuesday, of which Representatives is it Claiborne and Norris are there at the meetings and representing the Democrat caucus on the House, and then Senator Gustafson and other Republican senators are part of that. So this was agreed to by all four parties. So, and they'll be amending their bill, too.
All right. Perfect. Thank you. Any discussion on the A-15? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A-15, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A-15 is adopted. The next amendment that we will take up is the A-14, and that's my amendment. What we are doing here with the
A-13.
So the A-14 is what we're on, and the bill in its current form has the data provisions housed in 13.39, and through some discussions with folks, we found a better home, a more appropriate home for that, and that's in section 13.392. So it moves it from the civil investigative data statute to the internal auditing section, which is a much better fit. And so that's what the amendment does. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A14, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A14 is adopted. Then we have the A13. And the A13 is also my amendment. I thought it would be a good idea for there to be a reporting requirement from the Inspector General's office. And so that's what this amendment does. It lays out the criteria for what should be in the report that comes annually from the IG's office. Any discussion on the A14? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A14, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A14 is adopted. Members, the bill has been fully amended in the committee. Are there member questions or discussion? Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Rep. Anderson. I know there's been a lot of work happening behind the scenes to try to get a bill that's workable for and agreeable. I just want to clarify that this bill in particular is one version of the bill. There is another version of the bill. So this bill in particular isn't necessarily bipartisan yet, but there's a bipartisan effort, I think, to connect those two bills. So I just want to clarify that a little bit. There are multiple versions out there, and as you stated, it's still being worked on. And so while I appreciate the ongoing efforts, I know there's still a lot missing from this bill. And so for that reason, I'm a no today, but I appreciate the ongoing effort.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson, for this bill. I do have a question about Section 9 of your bill that begins on line 5.17, and I do understand that one of the amendments we just adopted did delete one provision of that, lines 5.21 to 5.23. But what concerns me about what's still in the bill begins on line 5.24 to 0.26. It says, notwithstanding any laws to the contrary, the Inspector General may require a recipient of state funds to provide full and unrestricted access to all records, reports, plans, contracts, memoranda, correspondence, and other information created or maintained by the recipient. And what concerns me about this is it seems to do away with our privilege statutes. So there are many different privileges in statutes, for example, attorney-client privilege. This, to me, says it would be okay to breach the attorney-client privilege and provides that kind of information to the Inspector General. Or we have privilege for patients and their doctors, or patients and their mental health providers, or sexual assault advocates and victims they work on. So I'm really concerned that this would allow a breach of privilege. If you can address that, please.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. And maybe I can ask the nonpartisan staff to help. Is there anyone?
Is that you, Ms. Davis, or is that Nathan?
Okay. Nathan?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, so the status of any privileges is not addressed in the bill, so that is something that's not clear on the face of the document yet.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. We will bring that up to our working group, so thank you.
Thanks. Representative Mueller.
Yeah, thank you. Just so I'm clear with Mr. Hopkins, it's were you saying it's not addressed and that this would potentially violate those privilege statutes because of the notwithstanding any law to the contrary? I just want a little clarity.
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Mueller, it's just not clear in the bill yet whether or not attorney-client privilege documents would be accessible to the Inspector General or not. That potential conflict is not addressed in the language.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for that clarification. And I would be interested in making sure that all privileges, not just attorney-client privilege, I forget what chapter they're in, 529, 620, something like that, that all of those privileges that are listed in a different statute be excluded from this.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. And I'll be in contact. You can join us on Tuesday nights.
Be careful what you wish for. Yeah. All right. Any other questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Anderson, initially you started out by saying that probably most of us have heard the bill, and I have not.
Okay.
I don't actually think it's accurate that most of us have. And this is a really important bill, obviously, and it's making a lot of stops, but I think this is one of its key stops. And I think you see that by the fact that Chair Scott took the time to really comb through and do some amendments that she thought were important. I have some concerns about this in terms of its constitutionality and what we're really doing here. And I'm not, I haven't been involved with the, you know, any of the, I'm not on the fraud committee or, you know, but I do have a concern that we are taking an approach that maybe doesn't actually achieve the goal that we're looking to achieve. So you said in your opening remark that this had to, this was going to help prevent fraud. And my understanding is that the problems we've had with fraud, it's not fraud within our government. It's people defrauding us who are not in government, who are getting money from government. Not that it could never happen, of course, that we could have fraud within government, but that has not characterized Minnesota. I mean, we have, you know, some other states you look at, there have been governors who've gone to prison, for example, after their terms. That has never happened in Minnesota. We just don't really hear in Minnesota of anybody, of any corruption within government. We have really good public servants here who try very hard to do their jobs the right way. And I, you know, I've never really heard anybody dispute that. But it seems like this bill is more focused on inside the agencies. And I could you just explain what the how this bill is attempting to prevent fraud? And please explain why that has to happen from within the legislature and not from with not within the executive branch, because I think there are different ways we could be looking at this.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Our last joint meeting with the Senate and the House last Tuesday night, which seems like a long time ago, but it was only 2 days ago, we had nonpartisan staff, including legal staff, and they actually said that the House version, which has it within the legislative branch, side by side with the legislative auditor, actually had did not have constitutional issues, and the Senate version as written has constitutional issues. So I think it was the opposite of what people had expected. And so we're continuing to work through that. We haven't come to agreement, the House and the Senate, authors on that, but it was actually the opposite, the way the bill was written. So we're very cognizant of making sure that this bill in its final form is absolutely constitutional and absolutely does the job that it's supposed to do. In on page 3, if you start with 3.8, recipient of state funds. So the Inspector General's essentially is, let me go down further, 3.18, the purpose, investigate and combat suspected fraud, misuse, another unlawful use of public funds in state government with a focus on the providers and the recipients. And if you go back up and talk about what are recipients of state funds, it's any entity or person, including persons that receive, disperse, have custody of funds under a program. The recipient of state funds is not limited to a private person or entity that currently or formally contract with the state in providing benefits, goods, or services. So the recipient of state funds essentially are vendors, and that's who we're looking at. It's not individuals. I absolutely agree with you, Representative Liebling, that our state employees are, you know, want only the best. Many are in, a lot of these programs are, frankly, in human services areas, and they made a decision to work and spend their career helping Minnesotans who need it and making sure that the dollars go to folks who need it and who are supposed to get the money as prescribed by this legislature within state programs. So the Inspector General is looking at what I would call vendors, whether they are businesses, whether they're nonprofits, whether they're the end user who's actually we are contracting with. And that's what's in the bill. Thanks.
Lead Leland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so the prevention question, mm-hmm. you said this is about prevention. How does it impact prevention, if you would?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Lee. It is more to investigate and combat those things, but I think helping with standards that are just done within the administration. Like we have the Department of Administration has an Office of Grants Management now, as we're all aware, and that office is attempting to put together some things which should help down the road, like laying out general policies and procedures for state agencies. That's within the executive branch, but they're attempting to do that and to quote prevent this sort of fraud. But the Office of Inspector General will have insight and to help with some of these things too. But the main focus is to investigate. And that's what OIGs do within the agencies currently, or are supposed to do, many of which positions aren't even filled right now. There's no one there.
Lead Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, so I still have concerns about the constitutionality, and notwithstanding that you said, oh, we're going to think about that, this is the committee here where we think about that. And so I can't help but feel like this is this bill is kind of like building the airplane while it's flying. Mm-hmm. And it gives me a lot of concern because it's a very important mm-hmm. bill and has both potential, I suppose, to help us with help that we need, but also to be a big disruption and possibly a big waste of resources, frankly. So I understand that MMB is here in the room and I'd like to see if they have a comment on the bill. But I think, from my point of view, it just really isn't ready. And I would hope, I don't think this is going to happen, Madam Chair, but I would hope it would come back to us when it's in its final form, because it sounds like it could be considerably different when it actually goes to the floor. And I think this is, some other committees, I'm sure, feel ownership over the bill, but I think we have significant interest in this committee in making sure that the bill is right. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. I don't think good characterizes we're going to think about it. We actually have nonpartisan legal staff who said that this bill is constitutional and the Senate has problems with the Senate bill, Gustafson's, has problems with constitutionality. So I have full faith that this is constitutional. And the question is whether it's a issue of being in the executive branch or the legislative branch. I mean, that's the constitutional question. And we've been told it's fine, that this is fully constitutional. If it wasn't, I would switch.
Thank you. And we do have a testifier we have Deputy Commissioner Britta Wrighton. I probably botched that. I apologize, from MMB. Go ahead and come to the table and give your testimony. And then we have a couple of more members on the list. Just to know, let everybody know here that we have a full agenda today. And I understand the importance of this bill, but we do have a full agenda. So let's keep the comments to the committee's purview. If it's something outside of that, it'll be handled in a different committee. Go ahead and state your name and go ahead.
Thank you so much, Chair Scott and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Britta Wrighton, Deputy Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank you for the opportunity to provide just a few remarks regarding House File 1. And I'm going to focus on that separation of powers consideration that's been being discussed. But first, I just want to make very clear that fraud against public programs designed to help improve the lives of Minnesotans is absolutely unacceptable and harms the people that benefit from the access to these programs. So the topic of improving both the identification and the investigation process of fraud throughout state government is very important, and we appreciate the conversations that we've had with Representative Anderson and the dialogue that's developed around this bill, and the engagement as well from the broader legislature. With this in mind, I do want to offer some input on the provisions of House File 1 as it's relevant to this committee's jurisdiction. Since the executive branch is responsible for implementing, enforcing the laws, an OIG is tasked with detecting and investigating potential fraud and misuse and other unlawful uses of public funds. There will need to be really strong integration between the executive branch and the legislative staff while maintaining some due operational independence. So House File 1 does direct the newly created legislative branch OIG to embed assistant inspectors general and other staff as determined by the inspector general into specified state agencies. And again, we do believe that this close collaboration with the OIG and agency staff is really absolutely necessary for the success of this work. However, as has been highlighted, the Minnesota Constitution supports a strong division among branches of government. So by embedding employees of that office in state agencies, we do think this blurs some lines between the executive and the legislative functions and will likely raise questions about the parameters of that engagement between the staff, the legislative staff embedded in the agency and the executive branch staff in that agency. Just want to point out, in contrast, what we've seen across the United States with other centralized OIGs consistently is that both in the states and the federal government, they place this function within the executive branch, but with various models for oversight and advice from the legislative branch. So just want to highlight, we do see some tension there. I know that this is still an ongoing conversation about this separation of powers question. We welcome continued ongoing conversation on this topic. Also, just quickly before I close, I want to highlight for the committee that the governor also has a fraud prevention package that would give agencies tools to strengthen oversight, investigation, and enforcement activity, improve detection, and also increase criminal penalties. So thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for your testimony. It goes without saying that we are all around this table concerned about the amount of fraud that's been found out recently, and we do want to nip it in the bud to the extent that we can. And I appreciate Representative Anderson's willingness to work bipartisanly to come up with the right solution. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the time that we're getting on this. I also have never heard this bill, and it is HF1, right? I presume it is the number one priority of the caucus this year. So I think it's important. So I'm curious about also the access, the data access. Specifically, I'm curious if the Inspector General's office, like let's say this bill passes, we create an Inspector General's office, we hire an Inspector General. Is this bill or the work we are doing, and I also think it's hard to know what we're talking about when we're talking about something that's not going to be the bill, but is it going to be forward-looking, or is it going to be forward and backward-looking, those investigative powers?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Representative Finke. We talked a little bit in the last committee about time frame. So this bill goes into effect in July. It will, in my experience, in my past, it will take probably a year to actually create this, to hire the staff, to transfer the positions that may be transferred. And so now we're about, you know, probably a year and a half from now out. In the meantime, the existing OIGs within the state agencies will continue to do the work that they're doing within there. So I suspect most of it will be going forward, but as you know, there's potentially issues that are going to come to this OIG, that things that have already happened, right? Criminal things that have happened or fraud that has happened that, you know, they would see. So it's probably a mix, but just understand the time frame. So,
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that answer. I mean, just, I guess, more to the point that the availability and access to data for the Office of Inspector General is different under this bill than other, you know, availability of access to data, right? Which is what Representative Mueller was talking about. This will extend access to potentially a great deal more of private information. And I would like to know if that at all the data that's already existing in our state government's hands will also be available, or if we're looking only forward at that. And I will say that what, you know, just frankly, we've heard a lot about waste, fraud, and abuse, and this bill seems to be mostly directed at fraud, you know, but I don't quite know what we're talking about when we're talking about those things. I'm a member of the waste community. Generally, when we spend money on my community, it is considered waste. So I want to know, are we going to go backwards? Mm-hmm. Are we going to look at the things that we have already done that has created a sense of this is what we want? This is what we shouldn't have been doing in the past, because it also gives, you know, this person's office, they get the right, they can observe, monitor, specify debar grantees, prevent or minimize specific grantees as necessary at the judgment of the inspector general. They get to make recommendations. The recommendations goes to the commission. Like, this person's job will be not just to monitor, but to actually direct whether or not grants that have potentially been provided by the legislature are allowed to be given based on the judgment of the inspector general, according to the language of the bill, it seems to me. So if we're just going to really put all of that investigative power into the office of this person, all government data, regardless of classification, forward and backwards, we just need to know that in advance and make sure that's very clear. So I would love to know, is that what we're talking about? All data across the government in perpetuity, forwards and backwards.
Thank you.
Ms. Anderson.
I'll try to find the answer. Is there Mr. Hopkins, or can anyone?
Mr. Hopkins.
And I believe that the language is the same as what the legislative auditor currently has. Pick the language from there.
Go ahead, Mr. Hopkins.
Oh, Madam Chair and members, so you can see the Inspector General, their data access language in the A15 amendment at 2.15 to 2.16 in particular. It requires public officials to produce and exhibit all books, accounts, documents, data of any classification and property that the Inspector General requests to inspect. So that's the bill's language regarding the Inspector General's ability to access data. This is substantively identical to the current language for the legislative auditor at 3.978 in current law. The legislative auditor, public officials are required to produce and exhibit all books, accounts, documents, data of any classification and property that the legislative auditor requests to inspect. So that's the legislative auditor's current language. So the language in the bill regarding data access is substantively identical to the current language that applies to the legislative auditor, if that's helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. And I think I can anticipate what your question might be. Does the OLA, does this language allow them to go backwards and forwards with seeing data?
Madam Chair, so this language would allow the OLA or the inspector, or allows the Inspector General to access any data that exists. And also to subpoena officials and employees and ask them questions. Any data that currently is in existence in those offices.
Thank you. So, Representative Finke, one more little question. We got to move on.
Yeah, I understand. This is very important to me. I understand that the data access piece is the same for the legislative auditor, mm-hmm. but is the legislative auditor, as I understand it, does not monitor the commission and monitor all of the agencies and monitor everything and create investigations on their own and, you know, what is being done with the data access here is not the same thing that the legislative auditor is doing. There is no discretion. There appears to be no discretion on what the Office of Inspector General here would be able to do with that data in terms of whether or not to recommend money goes out or doesn't go out, and how that's going to be used is very different to me. If I'm misreading this, I would appreciate being corrected, but I does feel to me like if we read the data practices through the enhanced oversight of state grant making section of the bill, it's an extremely wide wide parameter of power.
Representative Anderson.
We'll take a look at that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Finke, for those comments. I don't believe that there should be a statute of limitations as to how far back we should be able to look for defrauding taxpayers. I think we should be able to do that in perpetuity in the past and going forward. And to address some of Representative Liebling's comments earlier regarding the constitutionality of this, first and foremost, the nonprofits or organizations or entities, for-profit or otherwise, that would be receiving state funding, they're doing so knowingly and mm-hmm. in a contractual right. agreement. Right. So they would be notified of this beforehand. I believe the only constitutional concern that arises is if there's executive authority or appointment or oversight of this Office of Inspector General, because then it is first inherently political, and it's the executive branch taking over the duties of the legislative branch when it comes to funding. So I just want to make sure that this stays in the version that it's in rather than the Senate version, which allows a governor who, say, oversaw $640 million in fraud to appoint somebody who's inherently political who is tasked with overseeing that fraud that's occurred in the administration. So I appreciate you bringing this bill, and those are my comments.
Representative Reddick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just really quickly, because I do serve on the Fraud Committee, as does Representative Anderson and Representative Hudson. And through that work, Madam Chair, we've had a lot of opportunity to talk to whistleblowers, and I've talked to several dozen whistleblowers from primarily one state agency, but a little bit throughout others. And the theme that I'm hearing from those whistleblowers from inside of the state agency is very, very clear, that the executive branch should not be monitoring the executive branch, and they had really hoped that not only our Fraud Committee, but also whatever we put together from the legislature, whether it be something within the legislative auditor's office or separate from the legislator's office like this, that it would not be housed in the executive branch. And I actually have a message from one of the groups that I've been speaking to, and it goes so far as to say that the governor has not been a trustworthy partner in fraud. And so that's people from the very inside, Madam Chair, that are very, very concerned that this be housed in the executive branch, notwithstanding whatever kind of constitutional issues we have, because we can definitely talk about that. But I'm just talking about those that are trying to fight fraud each and every day, and they are trying to do a good job, and they've been thwarted many times. But we'll talk about more of that in the Fraud Committee. But I think it's important to understand that those that are trying to fight fraud, that we've talked to dozens of people within state agencies, really would like this outside of the executive branch. And that's all I have to say. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson, thank you for being here today. Mm-hmm. And just if you'd indulge me for a bit, can you tell me, I see in the bill that it requires all active investigations. This is line 17.31, 17.32, where it requires a transfer of active investigations, obligations, court action, contracts, recs, and personnel over to this office. Do you know how many staff are going to be transferred over to this office?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. That is being agency by agency worked on with the agencies right now. For example, the MDE OIG just has very few staff. The HHS has several hundred people that report to that OIG. And but they don't need to. They don't need to be part of the OIG. They're really not. So there are things like within Medicaid and so on that should stay within HHS, even though right now on an org chart they're directed to the OIG. So I expect that in the end this will be about the size of the legislative auditor's office. It will be definitely under 100 people and could be significantly lower than that. So,
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that answer. And for those individuals that will be transferred over, will they maintain their same job titles, status, and salaries and benefits?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. That was discussed. We actually, that was part of one of the amendments, and the MAPE, I've had the MAPE guy come into all the hearings so far, and he's not testifying in this one, so maybe he's happy. But not directly, because right now people have titles of inspector generals, and we're going to have one, right? And then we're going to have assistant inspector general. So it would be set up just like the legislative auditor's office, where you have the top deputies and so on, who are in the unclassified service. The rest of the staff will be in the classified service. It's exactly, we are trying to mimic the legislative auditor's office, because they'll be side by side, and they and not doing very different things. The legislative auditor is really focused on financial issues, right, and audits. They audit the state agencies, amongst other things. Sometimes they do these special reviews, which are actually requested by this body. The legislature makes those requests, what we're going to do. The idea is that it will be very similar. And we know it works. The legislative auditor, that works for all of us. It's nonpartisan. It has functioned extremely well for decades. And it answers ultimately to us, to this body. And so this will do the same. But we're being very careful. The OIG cannot dictate where grants go. For example, that is an agency prerogative, and that gets into that constitutional, you know, question. So did I answer your question?
Representative Frazier.
Yes, thank you. And then my final piece is, so I want to make sure, so you mentioned classified, unclassified. I want to make sure that none of these workers are going to lose their job protections that they currently have now.
Representative Anderson.
I'll have to go into each of the plans. You know, I mean, I can't be that specific directly, because we don't know exactly which people, but they will be in the classified service.
Final.
Representative Frazier.
Final one. And that will be very helpful. That's very important. And I think it's very, very important to all of us. We've talked about the desire for this to be an independent, nonpartisan, unpolitical role. And that comes with protections. If there are job protections, without fear or favor, these investigators can do those investigations. They can do that work and not be concerned that someone's going to come in and terminate them based on retaliation because they're doing that work. And I just have to say this, I have to point this out. We are seeing this happen right now in this country. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure that that is not the model that we're following here in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Anderson.
And thank you. And I very much agree. They need independence. They need to absolutely be able to do their work. And so that's why we are trying to make this independent within a legislative branch that's overseen by a completely bipartisan independent commission to take politics out of this. Because I think that's part of the problem right now that we have.
Representative Feist.
Thanks.
Madam Chair, I had some concerns around data privacy. On line 5.21 is the powers to have access to full and unrestricted access to all government data, regardless of classification, created and maintained by the agency. And I'm just thinking about the Department of Public Safety and specifically the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. They receive and share data from across the country, and it's highly sensitive information. And I feel that the A13 Amendment goes part of the way towards ensuring that we have some sense of who has access to this data and what data was accessed, but I don't know that we're there yet. I think we should think about audit trails, and I think we should think about whether or not we want anyone to have access to, like, unrestricted access to, for example, the Fusion Center. And I was wondering if you've thought about those issues.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. And Representative Feist, I actually circled this, so someone else, I think, brought this up earlier. So it's circled in my notes to bring to the committee and the lawyers. So thank you.
Mr. Hopkins, I have a question. Does the OLA, do they create audit trails, and do they have any of those parameters around the work that they do?
Madam Chair, there's not a statutory requirement for the OLA to create audit trails regarding its data access.
Okay.
The OLA is subject to the Data Practices Act, however, and so would the Inspector General under this bill.
Thank you. Representative Feist?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for thinking long and hard about these issues. And then I also just wanted to flag a separation of powers issue on the A15 amendment. line 2.22, we're talking about what, like, we, the legislature, are compelling the district court. So it says, the district court in the county where the order or subpoena was made returnable must, on line 2.23, must compel obedience or punish disobedience as for contempt. And we, the legislature, don't have the power to dictate to the courts how they would handle a case before them. So I think that needs to be addressed.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I'll circle that, too. This was actually the Senate language that we agreed to. Senator Gustafson's bill.
Representative Feist.
Back to her.
I was going to say something snarky about the Senate, but I won't. But, yeah, I do think, like, there's obviously a lot of work to be done on this bill. It's a very big, complicated, important bill, and so perhaps it could come back to Judiciary, the most important committee in the House. We'd love to see it again.
And the best. thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, I will renew my motion that House File 1 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Children and Families, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. Thank you, Chair Anderson.
Thank you.
Or not Chair.
Not
Representative.
Chair. Vice Chair. That's high as I get here. So.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 25. Representative Elizabeth Nakar is here with her bill, and we'll give a couple seconds here for all the transition. And while we're getting positioned, I want to point out that the reason that this bill is here, our jurisdiction covers Subdivision 5 and Subdivision 6. So that's lines 3.12 to 3.33. Anything outside of that, we will not be discussing. Members, I will move House File 25 and recommend that it be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. We have the bill before us. Representative Zelenstakar, tell us a little bit about your bill, and then we'll move to amendments.
Thank you, Chair Scott and members. House File 25 is a supporting women bill. It appropriates $4 million each year, $3 million to pregnancy resource centers, and $1 million to the maternity homes. It's grant money that would be funded through the Minnesota Department of Health. This supports women with options. The state right now spends money. We have money spent, about $25 million in the reproductive health grants, and this allows options for women. And when they're not options, there really isn't choice. The word choice implies that there would be options. The positive alternative grants were funded in Minnesota from 2006 to 2023. It was 17 years of bipartisan support, established in 2005. The House voted 112 to 17, and the Senate voted 53 to 11. This bill is an important bill for Minnesotans, and Chair Scott, that is the bill.
Thank you, Representative Zelenstakar, for bringing the bill forward. We're going to move to amendments now, and I will start by offering the A4. And what this does is it tightens up the language for the reason that the bill is here, and it just basically says that a women's pregnancy center or maternity home, that the data that they take, that they would have in their possession, are classified as private on individuals, as defined in current statute under 1302 sub 12. We just want to make sure that is crystal clear. And just as far as the other section of this bill, it does deal with the Minnesota Health Records Act. I know Chair Liebling is very familiar with the Minnesota Health Records Act. You and I have gone back and forth on that before, usually in unison on that, speaking the same language.
Happily, yes.
Yes. So, and the Minnesota Health Records Act protects our medical privacy. So With that, I will move the A14 discussion, or the A4. Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A4, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A4 is adopted. The next amendment before us, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative, for your bill, this amendment achieves two things. It ensures that crisis pregnancy centers will offer their services to all members of Minnesota's communities. These are institutions that are, you know, often, and I'm not looking to get in the way of this, but they are often run by organizations with certain political or religious perspectives, and I just want to make sure that we have protecting this coverage and this care for everyone under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And then the second part is it deletes the line that stipulate that an organization is eligible for a state grant under this bill if they provide abortions, promote abortion, refer people. You know, we know what this language does. You said you want to make sure that this bill is intended to support options, and abortion care is legal and safe health care in the state of Minnesota. And I believe that if we're going to give people options, we should give them all the options. So I would restrict the language that would require that those options be ignored and taken away from patients.
And Representative Finke, I'll move the A3. I didn't do that in the first place, but the A3 is before us. Representative Leadley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and I support the amendment. And I just wanted to add one comment to that, and that is I really think that when we're talking about saying that people are not allowed to promote abortion, I think that's a First Amendment violation. And you know, even though I know Representative Elizabeth Carter saying this is about women, giving women choice, and we spoke about this also in the Health Committee, I don't think the underlying idea is a bad idea. But this bill, as it's written right now, is definitely not a bipartisan bill. As it's written right now, it's an anti-abortion bill, in my view. And I think what Representative Finke's amendment does is it takes that part of it out and makes it actually a bill about helping people who are pregnant and or have just had a baby, which is something that we do a lot of in this state, and I think we all know we could do more of it. So I think the amendment is helping the bill, and I would urge members to support it.
Representative Zeliznagar.
Thank you, Chair Scott, and thank you, Representative Finke. The bill does not permit discrimination under the Minnesota Human Rights. I mean, there's already enforcement mechanisms that would be effective for anybody, for individuals in any business, in any practice. And so we have that right for all of us right now. And so that piece is taken care of. As far as businesses also are open to the public, all businesses are. So that human rights piece is, to me, not relevant in this for that reason. And the other part of line 17 to 25 that you're referencing, this is a separate bill. This bill is restoring funding that was stripped away in 2023. So this is a specific bill to return to the model that Minnesota was under for 17 years to allow for positive alternatives. So the positive alternatives grants have a lane, and the sexual and reproductive health grants have a lane too. And so for that reason, I would urge members to vote no.
Thank you, Representative Zeliznagar. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm reading the language very closely, and it just says you can't use this grant money. It doesn't say that the organization cannot talk about abortion or advise about abortion. It just says you can't use this money to do that counseling. So there's no First Amendment issue here, because they can certainly do it with other money. They can fundraise. They can get other grants. They can do other things. But this grant, you can't use this money to do that specific thing. So there's no constitutional issue here, Madam Chair.
Representative Finke, it's your amendment. You have the final word before we take a vote.
Thank you. Just really, really quickly, the bill language does say you are not eligible for the grant under those circumstances. So I do think that's not correct. I'd be interested in having that conversation and making sure that as many people are having all of the options available to them as possible. And Madam Chair, I'd ask for a roll call.
Okay, the A3 is before us. All those in favor of adopt?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Roll call has been requested. And so the CLA will take the roll.
Chair Scott?
No.
Vice Chair Hudson?
No.
Representative Bliss?
No.
Representative Corinne?
Aye.
Representative Duran?
No.
Representative Engen?
No.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Finke?
Aye.
Representative Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Mahmoud?
Aye.
Representative Moeller?
Aye.
Representative Rarick?
No.
Representative Steer?
No.
There being six ayes and seven nays, the motion is not adopted.
Madam Chair, we'd like a roll call on the bill as well.
Okay, and a roll call has been requested on the bill as well. With that, we will move to testifiers. We have a list of those. The first testifier I have on my list is Lanisha Karen from Pregnancy Choices, and on deck is Jay Belcito. Jay Belcito can go ahead and take a seat in the other chair at the table here, if that's all right. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go on with your testimony.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Scott and members. My name is Lanisha Karen, and I'm the Executive Director at Pregnancy Choices in Apple Valley, Minnesota. I am here today to share my support for HF25, which restores funding to pregnancy resource centers, creates funding for maternity homes, and allows our organizations to support Minnesota families, but really anyone who walks through our doors, and to care for them. I have served as the executive director at Pregnancy Choices for just over 4 years, and it has been a privilege to watch our clients thrive. Our HIPAA-compliant CRM system protects our client data, allowing us to serve our clients and respect their confidentiality. Maintaining our clients' privacy is a top priority of Pregnancy Choices, especially since so many clients come to us when they have nowhere else to turn. In 2024, we served just under 700 clients, with a total of over 2,500 client visits in the year. For most of our clients, we are in relationships with them for long term. They come to us for many visits before that relationship concludes. We are here during our client's pregnancy decision and long after. In 2024, over 700 of the 2,500 client visits were moms coming to our Baby and Me programs, where they were equipped with parenting education and tools to lead their families well with the care of a certified life coach. We spent nearly $50,000 in 2024 alone on client material services and did not bill our clients for any of these material supports or these services. That money went directly towards meeting their needs that would have otherwise went undone with things such as diapers, wipes, car seats, and stroller combos. Additionally, Pregnancy Choices parenting programs have been independently evaluated for the past decade by a well-renowned research team from the University of Denver. Dr. Galena Rhodes, who leads the research team, shared a 10-year formal evaluation of Pregnancy Choices certified life coaching programs confirms consistently positive results, raising self-efficacy in our clients and reducing stress, even in uncertain times. Pregnancy Choices had been a recipient of the bipartisan grant previously discussed before it was cut from the budget, which allowed us to accomplish everything that I have shared today. We appreciate the legislators' consideration of funding community organizations like ours who serve our clients free of charge. Please support HF25, and thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for your testimony. The next testifier is Jay Belcito, and on deck is Jacinta Legassi. I probably really botched that, but go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape and present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Speaker and members of the committee. My name is Jay Belcito. I am a parent, a proud Northsider, a social worker, and a proud resident of North Minneapolis. I'm here to testify about my experience at a crisis pregnancy center, or CPC, because people in Minnesota deserve robust, unconditional support, not a covert anti-abortion agenda. I first accidentally stumbled into a CPC when I was 17 and 5 weeks pregnant. I was scared and looking to talk to a safe adult who could discuss my healthcare options with me. I did not have access to transportation or money, so I was relieved when I saw nearby there was a purported clinic advertising support for unexpected pregnancies and free ultrasounds. What I walked into instead was a religious organization where someone who was not a licensed medical technician gave me an ultrasound, a baby blanket, and showed me a book of families who would be eager to adopt my unborn child. I trusted this org because I believed they were a real medical clinic. They documented my private medical information and told me that if I had an abortion, I would regret that decision for the rest of my life and that I would have a higher risk for cancer. Their propagation of misinformation should be regarded as an ethical violation that undermines public health. CPCs, particularly those that are not staffed by medical professionals, are not bound by federal privacy laws such as HIPAA and therefore are not legally bound to protect their patients' information and confidentiality. They also lack the regulatory oversight that governs legitimate medical clinics. Fast forward 18 years, and I live close to a CPC on West Broadway in North Minneapolis, and I'm frustrated whenever I pass by and see pregnant people being deceived by what they believe to be a real medical clinic. CPCs are strategic in their location. They target marginalized people. They target communities of color, low-income communities, immigrants, transient communities like students. So-called crisis pregnancy centers are organizations that use misleading naming and advertising to appeal to those seeking abortion, only to instead persuade them to seek other options. The anti-abortion ideology of these centers takes priority over the well-being of pregnant people seeking care at these centers, causing them not to receive comprehensive, accurate, evidence-based clinical information about all available options. In Minnesota, they outnumber real abortion clinics 11 to 1. This is unacceptable. We must remove these predatory centers from our communities and replace them with healthcare that is medically accurate, unbiased, as well as resources for pregnant people and families free from a religious agenda. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The next testifier is Jacinta Lagasse. Please help me out with that name and go ahead. And then on deck is Samantha Nagler, and that will be via Zoom, as will be Sue McLaren. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Scott. My name is Jacinta Lagasse. I'm the Executive Director of Women's Life Care Center in Little Canada, Minnesota. Women's Life Care Center is a pregnancy medical clinic and resource center serving Ramsey County and the surrounding metro area. We provide free pregnancy testing, limited obstetric ultrasounds, prenatal and parenting education, life coaching, financial education, as well as maternal wellness and fatherhood classes. I'm here today to urge you to pass HF 25 and create a grant program that will help centers like ours provide these critical services to women and families in need. We primarily serve pregnant women and women who are parenting infants and young children. All of our services are confidential and completely free of cost. Last year, our clinic performed 314 pregnancy tests and 362 ultrasounds. We take seriously our responsibility to secure our clients' protected health information. Women's Life Care Center is not a covered entity under the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, as we do not take health insurance and not bill for services, but we do follow the Minnesota Health Records Act and the spirit of HIPAA by keeping our clients' protected health information and our donors' protected information secure and confidential. In 2024, we served 590 distinct clients. We facilitate over 5,300 prenatal and parenting education, life coaching, and maternal wellness sessions. Collectively, our clients watched over 325,000 minutes of valuable parenting education on infant safety, infant development, safe sleep practices, car seat safety, infant nutrition, and other infant care and safety topics. Our organization not only provides substantial parenting education programs, we also provide strong financial and material support to our community. Last year, we distributed nearly 45,000 portable cribs, car seats, diapers, wipes, clothing items, and other essentials. Our center provided or sourced $21,000 in financial grants to assist in paying for our clients' rent, utilities, and household furnishings. We maintain a small food pantry where clients can come and pick up non-perishable food items and household items. We also provide grocery gift cards so our clients can pick up fresh food for their families. In 2023, our center spent $377,700 providing direct client services to our community. 60% of our clients fall below the federal poverty guidelines and struggle to afford basic necessities. We serve a diverse client base where no one racial or ethnic group is the majority. We also work with a network of other agencies to refer clients for additional material services, medical care, mental health support, housing, legal aid, and numerous other essential services. I share these things to highlight the impact we have had with limited donor funding. Funding from the state could allow us and similarly situated centers to help even more Minnesotans flourish and build stable homes and communities. Please thoughtfully consider how the state could wisely spend taxpayer dollars to change lives for the better with proven results. Our state has a vested interest in the outcomes that centers like ours are driven to promote. Please vote yes on HF 25. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and we will work to get Samantha and Sue ready to go via Zoom. So it looks like we have Samantha. You can hear us. You want to get?
Yes.
Okay, and we can hear you. Thank you. Go ahead. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Samantha Nagler, and I am an Equal Justice Works Legal Fellow at Gender Justice. House File 25 would renew the state funding to Crisis Pregnancy Centers, or CPCs, which was removed during the 2023 legislative session. CPCs are anti-abortion organizations whose primary goal is to dissuade pregnant people from getting abortions. CPCs not only refuse to provide a refer for abortion care, which is a prerequisite to receiving grant money under this bill, but they also largely do not provide a refer for prenatal care. As of 2021, 95.6% of Minnesota CPCs did not provide prenatal care, and 54.4% did not refer for prenatal care. The result is that CPCs delay or prevent pregnant people from getting the health care they need, whether that be abortion or prenatal care. CPCs also make false and misleading claims. As of 2021, over 63% of Minnesota CPCs made false and biased claims. Almost a third of Minnesota CPCs promote so-called abortion pill reversal, which is a dangerous and unproven intervention that the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists says is unethical and not based on science. Although many CPCs present as though they are medical offices, the vast majority of CPCs do not have medical staff. As of 2021, only 9% of Minnesota CPCs claim to employ a physician, and only 20% claim to employ a registered nurse. Research indicates that when there are licensed medical professionals at CPCs, most are engaged part-time or as volunteers and are sometimes licensed in unrelated specialties. At least one Minnesota CPC's medical professional on staff was an optometrist. Because CPCs present as medical offices, they collect vast amounts of sensitive, personal information from their clients. Many CPCs claim that this data is protected under HIPAA, but because there is generally no licensed medical staff, neither HIPAA nor the Minnesota Health Records Act applies. This means CPCs collect personal health data with no obligation to keep it confidential, which is particularly concerning given the current climate of criminalization of pregnancy outcomes. This is not just hypothetical. In May 2024, Heartbeat International, one of the largest national CPC networks with over 50 CPCs in Minnesota, leaked the private health data of several of its clients. Finally, the state should not fund CPCs because CPCs' use of the funding is not adequately regulated, and there have been many reports of CPCs misusing taxpayer money. For example, in Minnesota, one former recipient of Positive Abortion Alternatives funding received $75,000, but allocated only 7% of its budget to services for pregnant people. Another recipient received approximately $65,000 per year, but served fewer than 20 clients per year. Funding should be given to regulated organizations that support pregnant people with material resources, but it shouldn't have a prohibition on discussing, providing, or referring to abortion. This bill will divert money away from unbiased and qualified healthcare providers and toward ideological anti-abortion organizations that delay and prevent pregnant people from receiving real healthcare. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The next testifier is Sue McLernan, Star of the North Maternity Home, and she will be joining us via Zoom.
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape and provide your testimony.
Yes, I'm Dr. Sue McLernan from Star of the North Maternity Homes in Duluth, Minnesota. I'm a prior recipient of the Positive Alternative Grants and one of the first maternity homes in the state of Minnesota to receive the grant funding in 21. We had a 5-year grant with the Department of Health and Human Services, and we had a wonderful, rigorous evaluation process. My career has been in healthcare administration, and this is a nonprofit that I founded in 2019. And we found, as we worked and collaborated with all the organizations helping moms and babies in the Duluth, northeastern Minnesota region, that we were missing a residential component. Maternity homes have made a comeback because there is a need for housing and for programs. Star of the North is under the not only transitional housing, but also a program. So what we do is support. I have a mom right now who ended up with drug use, was pregnant, went through recovering services, and needed a place to live and continue her recovery journey. She is in our home. She is doing great. She is back to school at a community college and doing wonderfully. At our home, which is staffed 24/7, because we believe that we need to be there to support our moms and our babies. We have it in a very home-like environment. We provide 20 rooms between our two homes in Hibbing, Minnesota, and in Duluth. Our moms come to us from domestic violence situations, from recovering situations, from couch surfing, from living in their car, and they don't do well in regular shelters. And so we did the community assessment and worked with our local homeless shelters, and they refer these moms to our facilities. It is a program, so they have to not only want to come and live, but also work on getting back to independence. We believe that through education and or through working to get moms who are 12 times single moms with children are 12 times more likely to end up in poverty unless we can help them get back on their feet. So our program was a recipient, as I said, and it was torn away from us with about 30-day notice. And for our organization, it's been a substantial challenge. We do both fundraising. We write other grants. I have to say that as a PhD in public health, our evaluation process with the Minnesota Department of Health was rigorous and excellent, and we were audited each year, and we created outcome measures of how many of our women attend the educational sessions we provide in-house so that it's easier for them and their child. We work with local ECFE organizations, certified educators from families in transition programs. Other ones in the community are all welcome. Our public health nurses come in and work with our moms. We've been able to get our moms to over 95% of their educational events. We're also track and provide transportation to ensure that they get to all their medical, dental, behavioral health, and or substance use appointments. And again, we're over 95% success rate at making sure they get the care that they need in our community. We have had only 2 preterm births, and we work very hard to get moms in while they're pregnant so we can help the maternal fetal outcomes that have gone down in our state go back up in the right direction. We provide access to life coaching. They over 90% attendance at those appointments. And we also provide over 12 to 1,800 transports. Sometimes medical transports helps, but is not always available. And they also use buses and all alternatives. And then we try to get them back to a vehicle and independence working with another community organization. We provided over 3,000 meals. They use their dollars to do their breakfast, lunch, and snacks, and we provide a family meal that they plan, and we work with them to develop nutrition and healthy living for them and their child. And so we use every day as an opportunity to work with them. We have a licensed social worker who does care management. They come in and create their own life care plan, and their program is individualized to their needs. The average age of our moms is 27. They come to us 17% pregnant, 20 with infants, 54% with toddlers, and 10 with older than 3 to 10 years of age. We serve 47% Native Americans, 37% white, 11 African, 5 biracial. So about 63% of our moms are from a diverse background. The average stay with us is 3 to 6 months. We do not have a limit as long as they work the program. We've had moms stay with us over 22 months. As long as they're working the program, they can stay and be part of our family. We have an annual budget of $490,000, about $245,000 for home. We added the Hibbing after we did a community assessment with all the organizations in that region and found that there was a need. and we have purchased both our homes and are working diligently to pay those off and to pay our bills. But that grant of $72,000 was very helpful for keeping our organization stabilized. And we appreciate Representative Natalie for working to restore this funding. We find that it takes about $115 per mom and per baby per day to staff to cover the costs of this program. But we find that we have about a 68% back to independence, and that's a wonderful rate. Our mom, recent moms, had her first birthday that she remembers since she was 14 years of age, and she is 24. She is back to school, as I said, and had a wonderful Christmas, and her daughter and her boyfriend are working both to recovery and doing very well. Those are what we're here for, is to help these moms, help these babies and their families get back on their feet.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. McLaren. And we're limited for time, but I really appreciate what your organization is doing for women and kids in that community. We have one person on the list, Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representatives Lesnikar, for bringing this forward. I want to talk about pro-choice. Let's define that. Choice would insinuate options. And it seems without this funding, we're actually saying as a state that we don't want those options. A recent NIH study actually cites 76% of women who seek an abortion, they cite economic reasons for having done so. And having gone to these some of these centers myself with my wife, seeing what they do and on such a tight budget, it was pretty moving. And, you know, if we're going to strip that funding, if we're going to take away that choice, and not only that, we're gonna prosecute them, which the AG has been doing, we should really think about what we're doing on. And we heard from one of the testifiers that regulated organizations should be the ones receiving resources. Notwithstanding that Planned Parenthood is not licensed in the state of Minnesota. And we also heard that these women's centers, they dissuade women from seeking an abortion. The same assertion could be made on, let's say, Planned Parenthood, that they dissuade women from having a baby. If these resource centers are providing the vital tools and needed items that women must have to have a baby, that seems like a no-brainer. So let's vote yes on this bill. It was bipartisan for many years, and all of a sudden it wasn't. And that's wrong on the face of it. So thank you.
Representative Zelizniagar, final comments on your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members. I appreciate the conversation. And the reality is this bill is not impacting Planned Parenthood or any other sexual health service grantees. This bill is restoring two more options for Minnesota women that existed for 17 years. When women have options, there's choice. It's that simple. When there are not options, there really isn't choice. The Minnesota Department of Health grew their budget by 90%. So restoring what happened for 17 years is going to affect that budget, is 1% of the MDH budget. And it's 4% for the existing sexual and reproductive health programs. So this is allowing all things to be possible in the state of Minnesota to support women. I urge you to vote yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Zelizniagar. A roll call has been requested, so the CLA will take the roll.
Chair Scott?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hudson?
Aye.
Representative Bliss?
Aye.
Representative Corinne?
Corinne, no.
Representative Duran?
Aye.
Representative Ingen?
Yes.
Representative Feist?
No.
Representative Finke?
No.
Representative Frazier?
No.
Representative Mahmoud?
No.
Representative Moeller?
No.
Representative Rarick?
Aye.
Representative Steer?
Aye.
There being seven ayes, ayes, and six nays, the motion prevails. House File 25 is amended, is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you.
The final bill we have for our consideration today is House File 428. Chair Scott, would you like to move your bill to get it before the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move House File 428.
We have the bill before us. I want to inform members that the intent is to lay this bill over for further discussion at a later date. Chair Scott, I see you have an author's amendment to House File 428 labeled DE1. May I have a motion to put the bill in the form the author would like? Or would you like
to explain your amendment?
Yeah, sure.
I'll move the DE1.
Would you like to explain the DE?
So the DE1 tightens up the definition of correspondence. We were getting some feedback on that from other organizations, and so we feel like we've tightened that up so that it's a better definition of what correspondence is and is not.
Is there any member discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Chair Scott, please present your bill as amended to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, as you can see in current law, if you look at the top of 428, it outlines several provisions there, and if you go down a little ways, it gives a definition of government records, and that pretty much includes everything but the kitchen sink if you look at that list of things that it covers. This law was written before email was a thing. So I was conveying that to some, shall we say, I don't know what generation you are, Gen CD, I don't know what you are. But anyway, this was written during the era of microfish, and people are like, what is that, like a tiny little fish? But so that's how dated this section of law is. And what we're trying to do with House File 428 is bring the statute up to date and make it clear while taking into consideration the electronic age in which we do business. What correspondence is, since most communication is done electronically. In 2.28 to 2.32, we define what correspondence is and what it is not. Then in 3.21 to 3.25, we say how long correspondence must be retained. It is essential that government keeps correspondence so that the taxpayers and the media, as well as our OLA and state auditor and other internal auditors within our agencies, can see how government makes its decisions, holds events, and conducts its business. You see, it may not seem so important until it is. With me today is Matt Elling with Minnesotans for Open Government, formerly Minkoji. And he will explain how this organization has helped citizens find significant answers that could only be found if government holds on to correspondence. And he will talk about a very important case where correspondence did not exist and the fallout from that. I want to point out that we are in the Wild West right now when it comes to retention. Some government entities are only keeping email correspondence for 30 to 60 days. I know local units of government have issues with this bill and the potential cost, and this bill is being laid over pending a fiscal note. I want to make it clear that my goal here is consistency in the law. I do not wish to make the lives of government entities more difficult. I am open to changes in the bill, but clearly there's a problem here, and it's time to work out a fix. With that, I will turn it over to my testifier.
Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Scott. I'm Matt Ealing with Minnesotans for Open Government. We are an all-volunteer, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that's focused on government data access. I'm going to truncate my prepared correspondence or prepared comments because I know there's a lot of people in the audience who are very interested in this bill, and I want to make sure to leave time for them. I just want to hit a couple of high points. We have been flagging this issue of government correspondence retention as an issue the legislature needs to get its arms around for several years. As we've seen more and more government entities reduce the amount of time that they're holding correspondence and other records for. And we interact with people from across the political spectrum all the time. They call us with questions about government data access. We try to help them out. I also individually and through other organizations have made a lot of data requests, and I'd like to introduce a couple examples of why this is an important issue from a policy matter, separate from talking about the technical issues. If you see Exhibit A in the packet we've prepared, this is a 2017 email that's part of a series of emails and other messages that I received from then Attorney General Lori Swanson's AGO office. I had been contacted by somebody who was curious about and concerned about immigration policy changes during the first Trump administration. They were curious what the AGO was doing, so I said, here's how you can find out. Helped put a data request together and got a lot of correspondence back. And I want to flag that as an important example because regardless of what side of a policy question one might be on, having access to a government entity's correspondence, their decision process, what are they doing, is important for everybody on all aspects of the political spectrum. If you look at Exhibit B, Exhibit B is an email, again, part of a series of emails from a guy named Ken Confidential to someone within the University of Minnesota who was working on the location and siting of a large data center project. Ken Confidential emailed the municipality, the University of Minnesota, back and forth for months without identifying to the public who was actually going to be the entity that was going to locate this data center. They had a municipality sign a non-disclosure agreement saying that even the existence of the agreement was not disclosable and did not real and no one knew until the very end of the process that the company was Meta. And if you didn't have access to all of these emails about this process, no one would understand what led up to the final decision to site that data center. If you look at Exhibit C, Exhibit C is a 2013 email from a series of emails that I got from the Minnesota Department of Human Services. In 2012, they had been told by the legislature to prepare a report about the value of managed care to Minnesota's public health care programs. And in the operating language of that legislative directive, they said hire an independent vendor to perform this function. But all of the emails indicate that DHS itself was largely the entity driving that report, even telling the vendor who and which critics could not enter comments into the report that was going to the legislature. So again, if you read the final report, you would have no idea that there was all this behind-the-scenes activity going on. So that's the value of having these records and having them around for a standardized period of time is something that we're very concerned about. As government entities change those policies. So I'll hold my further questions there and just want to thank the author for her focus on this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Ealing. We have about 20 minutes left just for everyone's information, both testifiers and members, and we do intend to conclude our business on time. I will call up the list of testifiers two at a time, let you know who's on deck. We are going to be keeping comments limited to 2 minutes for folks. I'll first call up Judy Randall, and on deck will be Rebecca Halshue, and she can take a seat up there as well. Ms. Randall, please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall, Legislative Auditor, and I think I can come in under the 2 minutes. As Legislative Auditor, you can understand that having access to information is really important to what we do. And so I would just say from our perspective, the longer agencies retain data, the better, but I do understand there needs to be a balance. I will say I am one of the people who is on the records disposition panel, so all of the records retention schedules from agencies cross my desk, and I review and approve agencies' retention schedules. And I have a couple sitting on my desk right now that have are proposing a 60-day retention for their email, and they're just sitting on my desk. I haven't approved them yet because that feels too short to me, but I don't have a standard in law where I can say 60 days isn't enough, you need to do it X amount. And I don't want to say, well, Judy Randall thinks it should be this many years or this long. And so I'm really looking for a standard, and that would be helpful. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a question?
Chair or Lead Liebling, go ahead and ask your question of the testifier.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Randall. Good to see you. Thank you for that. I'm just really my question is there authority that you have to approve how long people retain records? That's just kind of new to me that you are being asked to tell the agencies how long they must retain records. Could you just address that quickly?
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lead Liebling, nice to see you too. Yes, and actually it's in the delete all, the first subdivision that where there's no changes, it explains the records disposition panel, and it's the Attorney General, the Director of the Minnesota Historical Society, and then either the Legislative Auditor or State Auditor, depending on if it's a local government or state government. So agencies, anytime they want to update their records retention or if they're establishing a new office, they send around a thick, it depends, but they send around kind of all their different types of records and propose retention for it, and then we need to sign and approve it.
Lead Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I won't continue this, but that clears up my confusion because it says part of that group that you're talking about, not as an individual actor. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We will move to Rebecca Holshue. Please identify yourself for the record and correct my pronunciation if needed and provide your testimony.
Good morning and thank you. My name is Rebecca Holshue. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney speaking on behalf of Hennepin County today. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on this bill. The county is committed to transparency in local government. And as we look to improve Chapter 13, we want to make sure that transparency is both meaningful and administrable. The critical distinction in the law right now is whether or not data is an official record. The Official Records Act correctly requires the government to keep, quote, all records necessary to a full and accurate knowledge of their official activities. Records take many forms. They can be digital, paper, or stored on some other medium. A text message that says, I'm running late to a meeting, is a government record, and so is a multi-million dollar contract that's been signed. Only one of those, however, is an official record. It's important to make the distinction between official records among the billions of other records we create so that we can better preserve and manage the records that are meaningful, those which are official records. Government has special responsibilities to preserve and manage official records. Official records must be inventoried. They must be retained for specific time periods approved by the records disposition panel. Official records may only be destroyed pursuant to that retention schedule, and even then, the government must make a list of every record that is destroyed. We appreciate that the Delete All Amendment removes the language that would have modified the definition of records in Chapter 138. That language would have created an extraordinary burden for government to maintain every piece of data created every day. However, the revised bill may still create confusion and result in unintended consequences. First, Section 138.17 applies to official records. This bill creates an extremely broad definition of correspondence, which includes both official and unofficial records, and then mandates that both be saved for 3 years. It's unclear whether all correspondence, even the official records, have to go through the same disposition process as official records. Next, the administrative burden created by this bill is significant. The bill creates a definition of correspondence that will include every single email, chat, and text message. Storing this data, organizing it, searching it, and logging its destruction does not meaningfully further transparency because most routine correspondence is not an official record. In fact, keeping all correspondence for so long, regardless of whether it's a meaningful record, works against two other goals of the Data Practices Act, protecting private data and timely responding to public records requests. Storing more data means there's more risk of disclosure of sensitive information in a data breach. And critically, storing more data inevitably means slower response times to records requests. Right now, county employees are trained to move official records out of email and into official repositories. County employees may delete emails that are not official records, and there's a default 3-year retention period for email. Even so, the county has more than 180 million emails right now.
Can you please wrap it up quickly?
Oh, yes. We also create about 3 million chat messages each month, which this bill would define as correspondence. Keeping all of this information means longer processing times. We would like the opportunity to work with the committee and the author on this bill, and thank you very much for your time.
Representative Finke, was your question specifically for this testifier? Okay, got it. We will move on to Joy Anderson, and then on deck will be Kathleen Duran Norton. Ms. Anderson, identify yourself for the record and go on with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Chair Scott and members. My name is Joy Anderson, and I am a supervising attorney at Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, which is a legal nonprofit with a 50-year history of protecting Minnesota's environment and the health of its people. MCEA supports House File 28 as an important measure to standardize record retention for government agencies. MCEA's particular expertise in this area is in environmental review and permitting, so that is the perspective that I'm going to speak to here. Environmental review is designed to involve the public and civic organizations like MCEA. One of the main purposes of the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act, which governs environmental review, is to make sure that the public is informed about any possible environmental impacts of decisions before they are made. Our agencies themselves have been clear about the importance of an informed public in our efforts to protect the environment. Based on our experience, clear and reliable record retention is essential to this. Many of MCEA's cases involve requests for governmental documents, which provide critical information that we use to inform Minnesota residents about what project proposers and their state agencies are doing. If agencies fail to keep records because of inconsistent policies, it can lead to the public being uninformed, agencies making unlawful decisions, and failures to live up to our environmental standards. For example, in one of the court cases regarding the proposed Polymet mine, the Minnesota Supreme Court explained that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency had failed to maintain documents relating to important discussions with EPA. This, the court said, was a danger signal, demonstrating that the agency's decision on the Polymet water pollution permit was unlawful. Straightforward across-the-board requirements for document retention for all agencies will help to avoid situations like this one, where information was not kept and provided to the public. I'm particularly concerned today to hear about the potential for a 60-day email retention policy, particularly when these requests can take months and months to respond to. Sometimes we wait 6 months, 9 months, longer to get our responses back. So what does a 60-day how does a 60-day retention policy interact with that 6-month wait? For these reasons, we would encourage you to vote yes on House File 428.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on deck will be Don Arnasty and Ms. Dora Norton. Identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, and thank you, Representative Scott, for putting forward this bill. I am speaking on my own behalf this morning. Your bill has already engendered quite a lot of discussion, and that is great. That is great. It's very needed. I've spent over 3 years as a data analyst, systems administrator, and data warehouse manager. Before I retired, a career making information available and accessible to people. There are some industries where there is a wall between the work and the conversation. In hospitals and clinics, for example, there's no emails that say, oh yeah, increase this dosage to a certain level for a particular patient. That goes on the other side of the wall. It's very clear. That's the side of the wall where the duty to the patient is kept. The other side is informal. We have already heard there is no wall, there is no bright line between that casual communication and the duty that democracy and government has to the people. Now we can create that with software constraints, and we can create that with strict protocols and definitions, but we don't have that now. In 2006, I was elected a township supervisor, and a few weeks later found that an ethanol plant had been talking to our county commissioners many times. And our township embarked on a moratorium, and a year later, when we decided to take back planning and zoning, the ethanol plant sued us. And we immediately had a request for every email from the last year. Now, townships are not under data practices, but prior board had designated our township as an urban township, and so it wasn't so clear. And so our clerk, thankfully, he had an email system. We don't have those anymore. The data didn't live in untaxed mega data centers. It was downloaded, and it filled several boxes of paper when it was all said and done.
I'll need you to wrap up.
The township can follow the goal of making records accessible to citizens. I think every level of government can. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Rich Neumeister, you can get on deck, and we will go to Mr. Arnasty. Identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Scott for offering this legislation. My name is Don Arnasty. I've had nearly 40-year career in Minnesota as an environmental advocate working for many public interest organizations on behalf of our shared interest and dependence in our natural environment. Today I appear before you as a volunteer board member and representative of one such organization, Water Legacy. We thank Chair Scott for offering and hearing this important legislation, HF 428, which we strongly support. We believe an accurate and transparent record of government actions is at the foundation of our democracy. This is a nonpartisan, bipartisan issue. It's a requirement. Without knowledge of how our governmental actions are determined, it's impossible for we the people to act in an informed manner at the ballot box, nor for you, our elected representatives, to fully understand the governmental actions you fund and oversee. The need for this legislation is compelling, as brought out by other testifiers. I offer one specific fact that alerted me to this issue and has not yet been highlighted. Early at the beginning of COVID, as we were all learning how to navigate online, state government was ordered to conduct its businesses by Microsoft Teams activities. That's become routine these days, but just 5 years ago, it was a brand new thing. Shortly thereafter, in July 6, 2020, MPCA staff newsletter, the following was published. Microsoft Teams chat auto-delete policies. Individual and group chats will be set to auto-delete after 1 day. Team channel chats posts will be auto-deleted after 14 days. This decision was made by senior managers team to help ensure Teams is a well-managed space that fosters collaboration and good records and data management. That eliminates all the conversations, all the records of where government was ordered to conduct their business at that time when everything was online. These policies remain in effect today. And these policies, I have confirmed, or similar policies, are in other state agencies, including the Department of Natural Resources.
I'll need you to land it.
Yeah. Much better is to pass House File 428 into law, requiring our governmental agencies to maintain and retain records of their actions, whether we favor them or not. And my only specific suggestion is to change the mandatory retention period on line 3.22 from 3 years to 25 years. It's not so hard in an era where we're talking about a few electrons in the cloud to maintain the records of what our government is doing. Transparency in government starts with data retention, and this is the only way in a democracy for all of us to hold our government accountable.
Thank you for your testimony. Rich Neumeister, introduce yourself. You're
Mr.
well
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. I support House File 428 for the following reasons. Number one, there's a right to know accountability is a public right. Minnesotans deserve to know what's behind their government. Folks in Crystal, Rochester have a right to know why a road project got delayed or a school funding deal was not struck, or particularly why a law enforcement agency decided not to go with a particular policy decision. Practicality meets modern tech is the second one. You know, this what's being proposed in the bill is doable with today's tech tools. Small towns may say, and I acknowledge some of the comments, can't afford this. But it's mostly use of Google, Microsoft. This three-year period can happen. And with the training of the associations that did some of the comments or the counties, it three-year retentions can be done. Number three, consistency across the state. This, if you do that, it ends the chaos on even practice, leveling the playing field for state and local agencies. Right now, Minneapolis may keep emails for 6 months, while an outstate town dumps them in 4 years. That's not fair to your constituents and the public and the people who want to know. Because whether you're in Hennepin County or in Monoman County, you want the same shot at the truth as to what happened. There also, as some speakers have said, this also is protection for accountability and risk. Keeping records 3 years shields governments from legal or public backlash about lost information, but it allows entities to be able to do things, to find out things. In the last 2 points, one, 3 years is not too long. The thing is that a lot of states are at this. And even if you go to the current archivist website, you'll see that's some of the recommendations that's already there. It's been that for years. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're going to probably be visiting this issue again because the public demands it. A lot of people demands it. And what the legislature is doing in the process to for more accountability. So this isn't about bureaucracy. It's about keeping Minnesota honest, accountable, and in the sunshine, which I believe of right to know.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, those are my comments.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We're going to go an extra 5 minutes here. We got two members on the list. I'll remind everyone that this bill is being laid over and it will be coming back to the committee. We'll have opportunity for further discussion at that time. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Scott, and to all of our testifiers. I know we're coming back, so I'll just bring up a couple of quick things. I mean, this is another one of those things where, like, when I come from journalism, I want our government records to be available to people. I think that's really important. The two things I would ask that we can maybe discuss more are the distinction between that purely personal and the correspondence definition, what happens to the purely personal messages or correspondence, and who determines how that looks. Will those be saved but not available? This week we saw 100 people laid off for employee research, not laid off, fired, as a part of an employee resource group in the federal space, and I'm just nervous about what that would look like. Also, what would the cost be to the local governments who are going to be keeping these? I know that all local governments are not created equal in terms of resources available to them, so I just want to know, are we going to support that? Are we going to carry those costs? How that would look, but thank you.
And Chair Scott.
Thank you, Representative Finke. Good questions, and we'll talk about the distinction between purely personal correspondence and what those distinctions are. And of course, the reason we're laying this over today is we're waiting on fiscal notes, and we know they're going to be substantial. I do want to point out, as Mr. Neumeister did say on the packet that Minnesotans for Open Government, I'm still having a hard time saying that, provided you. There is the Exhibit D, the back and front, the very back page of that packet shows that, and I didn't bring my cheaters up here, but Correspondence General, this has been approved by the Minnesota Records Dispensation Panel, and for general correspondence, the recommendation is 3 years. So it's already what is out there as the model. And so I think that's how I arrived at the 3 years, because that was what was on that. And so all of this is still very much open for discussion. And I think the testimony today was really good in laying out why the length of time matters and what's kept matters. So that's my comment for Representative Finke.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Scott. I think we all agree that government transparency is important, and I do appreciate the spirit of this bill, but I am worried about a number of unintended consequences, and one of those is the cost, again, to counties, cities, schools, and I'm assuming that the fiscal note won't necessarily reflect the cost to all of those entities, because some of those local pieces aren't necessarily there. So if I'm wrong, you can correct me on that. So the cost is one thing. The other thing is the data breach that was mentioned in some of the letters. And then the third point is just I'm really worried about people that want to use these requests as a sword rather than a shield. I think using it as a shield to make sure that government's doing what it's supposed to do is completely appropriate. But we have seen requests to use this really like a sword. And Rochester School District is one of those examples. They've incurred over $1 million to fulfill. These aren't like easy keyword searches they can do when they're trying to figure out what data to turn over. They said there's a for-profit corporation or company that is from Florida that's been making these requests. Some of the things they wanted, for instance, was a review of every course with, quote, a sociological theme for issues of equity that they explained was in a keyword search. So I'm just really concerned about this bill allowing it to be these requests to be used as a sword. Thanks.
Lead labeling. Oh, sorry. Chair
thank
Scott,
you, Mr. Chair,
go ahead and respond.
Respond real quickly. And thank you for those concerns, Representative Mueller, and I've no doubt I've heard those before. And I want to make it clear that in the Data Practices Act and in that it does say you have to work with the requester to try to narrow down the request. And so a lot of times that requests like that seem to be really broad can be, you can work with the requester and narrow those to the extent possible. If they're still dragging their feet on that, then you say, hey, this is a really broad request. It's going to take me, you know, X amount of months. And so, you know, you can expect your first batch in 3 months and then your next batch in another 3 months. So I think one of the things I know the Department of Administration is here, and they're very good at doing education for local units of government and that sort of thing to help them with those data requests and how to handle them. But I don't deny that there are issues out there.
Lead Leafly.
Yeah, thank you. Just quickly, I just want to thank Chair Scott for this bill. And obviously, this is a very bipartisan issue, and there are lots of moving parts and lots of interested players and lots of different concerns. And really, thank you for taking this on. And I know we talked about maybe landing on some kind of a more extensive process to help sort through all of this, but it's really important work, and just want to thank you for working with us on this and for work you I hope will continue to do on it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion, we will lay the bill over. Members, that concludes our work for the day. The meeting is adjourned.